D News. I'm Dave McGrath. Now, 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm pleased and honored to be able to be speaking with a well-known writer by the name of Tamara Winfrey Harris, whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, New York Magazine, The New York Times, Cosmopolitan, and many, many other places. You perhaps know a previous book called Dear Black Girl, Letters from Your Sisters on Stepping Into Your Power. Her most recent book, published by Barrett Kohler, is titled The Sisters Are All Right, Changing the Broken Narrative of Black Women in America. This is the second edition of this book in which Tamara Winfrey Harris takes aim without any hesitation at some of the caricatures and stereotypes that she feels have really broken the narrative of Black women, particularly Black women in America. And this updated version seeks to address those issues in new light. Tamara Winfrey Harris, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So, in a nutshell, at least, tell us why your book, which generated plenty of conversation upon its initial release, why you felt it was important to update it. What has, in a sense, changed that made an updated version necessary in your eyes?
So many things have happened in the last 6 years to Black women that are positive. You know, we have our first Black biracial woman as vice president of the United States. That's significant. Most recently, Black women were the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs, at least until, you know, COVID kind of made things go sideways. But we are still not free. We are still talked about in reductive ways. Even if we look at the triumph of someone like Kamala Harris, when you evaluate the ways she is often talked about, it is through the lens of old stereotypes of Black women. So charges that she slept her way to success, charges that she was too aggressive on the Senate floor or when she was debating Joe Biden, and the fact that she was not interesting as a primary candidate, but once Joe Biden became the Democratic nominee, people started talking about how a Black woman would make a good sidekick. So there are those stereotypes. So Jezebel, Sapphire, and Mammy, they are still with us and affecting how people see us, even as we gain ground.
I want to talk about those three caricatures, the servile Mammy, the angry Sapphire, the lascivious Jezebel. It's interesting that you talk about these three caricatures, because I suspect that a lot of people would say that those belong to a past age. And indeed, I mean, we hardly ever hear those caricatures talked about openly with those names. openly attached to them. Mm-hmm. And yet, as you, I think, very persuasively argue in your book, those caricatures are still very much with us, maybe in used in ways that are subtle, which probably in some ways makes them more dangerous. Just summarize, if you would, the ways in which you think these caricatures still persist.
So, you know, we've hardly ever talked about those caricatures by name, you know, unless it's academic. They just have become part of the air of, you know, American society. And there are these lies that have been told so long that they kind of feel like truth. So when we start talking, for instance, about single mothers, you know, Black women are often framed as bad mothers who are not intentional about their mothering. It's just kind of biological imperative. They're talked about as women who can't control their sexuality. So they are breeding and having sex too much. They are talked about women who can't keep husbands and partners as we believe women should. So they chase away men because they are too masculine or they are too aggressive. So those issues are often framed when we talk about societal issues, when we talk about Black women's place in society, those stereotypes start to arise, even as we evaluate popular culture. So when we look at figures like Megan Thee Stallion or Cardi B and the way they use their sexuality in entertainment, some of the way that's denigrated is through the lens and the idea that Black women are hypersexual and that is bad. And it's a lens that we don't use necessarily to evaluate men in entertainment and the ways they sing about sexuality. So those are some of the ways that those stereotypes persist. I say that like racism and sexism is like water. So it finds its way and it evolves and it finds its way into the cracks of things and it rots the foundation and we don't even see it.
We're speaking with Tamara Winfrey Harris about the second edition of her book, The Sisters Are All Right, Changing the Broken Narrative of Black Women in America. It seems to me that one of the most complicated facets of this is that we are talking about a broken narrative that is not one solely concocted by and perpetuated by, for instance, white men like me, or I mean, the places where we often think of racism residing, mm-hmm. but that we're talking about a broken narrative that also stems from the Black community itself. I mean, with, for instance, certain comedians on the stage that will perpetuate some of these caricatures that you were just talking about. And many of the instances that you quote in your book are from Blacks, Black men usually, probably even from time to time Black women, who also, for the sake of entertainment or making a joke or whatever, are perpetuating some of these caricatures. How difficult is that facet of this, the fact that this, in a sense, that we're talking about more than, I mean, it's one broken narrative, but in a sense, the source of it is not a simple thing to determine.
Yeah, because, you know, sexism and racism are in the air. It's part of society. And, you know, I breathe it as a Black woman, just like you breathe it as a white man. And so I absorb those same ideas about myself and other Black women that you are. And so, you know, you find those stereotypes in music, entertainment that's created by Black people. You know, I love my reality television, which very often is made to amplify and produced and edited to amplify some of those stereotypes. And then there's this other piece where it's the fear and concern we have for younger Black people. So what I've heard a lot from Black women is, you know, it was my mother that first told me that my skin was too dark or that I was too loud, or it was a aunt that told me that I was dressed and I looked like I was too fast. And that's because many of us know, you know, the penalty of even appearing to align with some of those stereotypes for younger women and girls. And so in our fear, we encourage them to just don't be who they say you are. And in doing that, we encourage them to give in to some of those stereotypes. And, you know, we make younger women believe that there is something wrong with them out of our fear for them and our hope that they will be accepted into American society. And while we expect to hear racism sometimes from white people, we aren't as able to recognize it when it comes from someone we love and we think has our best interests at heart.
Very well put. I found quite compelling the sixth chapter of your book called Strength, Precious Metal, in which you write about an essay that you wrote back in 2014 about, in your words, a stereotype that both buoys and burdens black women. With shades of sapphire's hardness, the myth embodies the idea of African-American women as perpetually tough and uniquely indestructible, strong black woman. And you go on to say in this chapter that this is something that can both hurt and help black women, that is, living with this particular stereotype. Explain how this image of the strong black woman, that at a glance might seem to be only a positive, can also be a negative.
So when I first started talking about the strong black woman stereotype, a lot of black women were like, wait a minute, that's positive. Like, I like this notion that my foremothers were, you know, they made it through and they were resilient. That inspires me. Why are you trying to take that away from me? But, you know, sometimes being resilient, because you have to be, is confused with one being indestructible. And just because you can withstand something doesn't mean you should. And so, you know, there's this idea that, you know, black women can withstand anything stoically, any pressure physically and mentally. You know, I was doing a book event in Atlanta, and an older woman said a remarkable thing. You know, we often hear black women absorbing the idea that because, you know, your great-great-grandmother was able to raise 10 kids during Jim Crow in the South, you know, in poverty and shared, like, all of this hardship, just because she withstood that, she shouldn't have had to withstand that. And just because she didn't have support, she should have had support. So don't use that past resilience as an excuse for not taking care of yourself as a black woman and for not demanding help. We are strong and resilient because we have had to be, but we are not unbreakable, and we deserve to not have to be strong and resilient all the time because it's killing us.
I want you to talk briefly about the aspect of the book that I found the most surprising, and that was the chapter in which you talk about beauty and of black beauty still being very much marginalized in American society. I just have to say that really has not been my own personal experience. That is, I can't think of a single person in my life in a single instance ever saying anything that would even remotely resemble this idea that a black woman can't be as beautiful as a white woman. But as I read that chapter, I started to realize that perhaps there are subtle ways in which, in fact, this is true. Can you just say a word about the way in which black beauty, in your mind, is quite often marginalized in a way that might catch a lot of the rest of us unawares?
You know, like we talked about earlier, a lot of these things are so subtle. So you may not hear anyone explicitly say black women are not beautiful. But, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s and my young adulthood in the 90s, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, you didn't see a lot of black women on the covers of beauty magazines. And when I read beauty magazines, when they talked about how to make yourself beautiful, or here's the latest makeup, or here's the latest hair trick, wasn't done on women who looked like me. It wasn't in colors that would look good on my skin. Those tips were not for hair that grew, you know, out of women's heads the way my hair grows out of my head. It is the fact that, you know, today there's this rise of the Black beauty aesthetic, but it is the Black beauty aesthetic on white women. So you see a lot of influencers on Instagram who are adopting things like cornrows and faux locks and, you know, twists, styles that, you know, when seen on Black women are somehow branded as too urban and not professional. But then white women who are influencers are able to monetize those and gain popularity in things that sometimes Black women are told we can't wear to work, to make money to feed ourselves. So it's this very tricky thing. Or how often do you hear, you know, white women's skin and their beauty is immortalized in song, and your alabaster skin and your blue eyes and your flowing hair in a way that Black women's features are not. So it's those subtleties that, you know, can share the idea or spread the idea that the way Black women look naturally is unacceptable. Hmm.
I appreciated that early in the book you acknowledged that things are better, but I think you say it well when you said things are better for Black women. Better should not be confused with good. And your book goes on to make that case very persuasively. The book again is The Sisters Are All Right, Changing the Broken Narrative of Black Women in America, published by Barrett Kohler. Tamara Winfrey Harris, thank you so much for giving this world this compelling book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're turning to the Morning Show archives for an interview recorded and initially broadcast back in 2017. It is no small feat to write a published novel. I mean, to write a novel that is picked up by a major publisher. And it's even more of an impressive feat when that first novel is as incredibly successful as Margaret Wilkerson Sexton's first novel, called A Kind of Freedom. The New York Times called it her luminous and remarkably assured first novel. And I must agree, this is a really exceptionally fine work, which I have so thoroughly enjoyed reading. It is set in the city of New Orleans, which is where Margaret Wilkerson Sexton herself was raised. And the novel follows the life experiences of three generations of the same family. And through the course of many decades, we are following kind of the course of history in this southern city and the plight of Blacks there, and how, in some respects, many of the difficulties remain the same, even as life changes and in halting ways, sometimes for the better, but always looming right around the corner is the possibility of some new trouble or disappointment. It's a emotionally rich novel and meticulously crafted with a beautiful eye for detail. And I have thoroughly enjoyed it, as have many reviewers across the country. And it is an award-winning novel, which is just now available in paperback from Counterpoint. Again, it is titled A Kind of Freedom. And Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you, and thank you for that welcoming introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, I really have enjoyed this book very, very much. The novel takes its title from something called All Aunt Hagar's Children by Edward P. Jones, and you have this quote right at the front. They were the children of once upon a time slaves, born into a kind of freedom, but they had traveled down through the wombs with what all their kind had been born with, the knowledge that God had promised next week to everyone but themselves. Explain a little further what you think is behind those words, and especially those four words that comprise the title of your novel, A Kind of Freedom.
Yeah, sure. So I had just left my job as a lawyer, and I was traveling, and I was reading that short story collection, and I came upon that quotation, and I thought, that's exactly what, I hadn't even started writing this book yet. I was working on something else, but I think behind most of the work, or much of the work that I create, is this urge to demonstrate the degree to which we are fettered by our past. And a lot of times that's just in a logistical way, because of systemic oppression, and it's very tangible and concrete, and you can look at certain systems and laws that have led to present day restrictions. But in some ways it's psychological too, and it's just the haunting of being raised by people who were raised by sharecroppers. And those people were raised by former slaves, and it's just how that how the shadow of that legacy would just follow you and haunt you. And so I tried to instill both that psychological and that very real those very real constraints into the book, and that's what that passage represents for me, the degree to which we're still fettered by virtue of to whom we were born.
Right. So in other words, even for a people who, at least on the surface and in every sort of official way, are now free of a bondage mm-hmm. that was once in place, there is a different kind of bondage, maybe more subtle, maybe invisible to the eye, that is still present, at least in the hearts of many. And it can.
That's right.
And it can still exert a kind of control.
Exactly. And it's a kind of bondage. It's a kind of control. And so we are only experiencing a kind of freedom. You know, it's not complete or absolute in that way yet. And so yes, I thought it was perfect for this book. The funny thing is, the book that I wrote before this that was never published had the same title. And I never thought it worked for that book. I was trying to use it for that book because I so loved that title and I wanted it to fit, but no one ever thought it quite worked for that book. And then that book never got published, and I started working on this one. And the original title for this book was Early in the Morning.
Hmm.
Yeah, but nobody could remember it. My editors, they would be like, you know that book, you know, really late at night, or, you know, or, you know, half past dawn. It was always some kind of reconfiguration of the title. And finally I was like, well, no, it wasn't me. Finally they were like, we need to change the title. No one can remember this title. So we thought about it for a while, and one of my editors thought that maybe it could be a title in Creole. And that didn't do anything for me. So I just kept thinking, and finally I was like, you know, I actually think that other book's title would fit really well here. And it did.
It certainly does. We're speaking with Margaret Wilkerson Sexton about her first novel called A Kind of Freedom. The framework of the novel is not easy. That is, we are talking about three different generations of the same family, and we alternate between them. And I wonder if you could talk about that framework and how challenging it was for you as the author to work with that framework in a way that does not leave the reader confused. And also, what about that framework do you think was beneficial to the overall effectiveness of your novel? Because we could have read about the earliest generation in part one of the book, and then proceeded from there to the second, and proceeded from there to the third. What do you think we gain as the reader by alternating back and forth and forth between these three different generations as we do?
Yeah, I think it plays with time to have the storylines be parallel, and I think it plays with the reader's perception of time and perception of history and how far removed it is from the present day. I was on this panel at Squaw Valley Writers Conference, and it was a historical fiction panel, and we were talking about why we use history, and we all had different ideas about it. But what I said was, I use history to show the degree to which things don't really change, and I think setting these storylines up almost as if they're happening in the same moment can really relay that in a way that I wouldn't have been able to relay if it were just three blocked passages, which I was thinking about doing. I was thinking about just doing, 75 pages of Evelyn and then 75 pages of Jackie and then 75 pages of TC. Actually, I was going to do it in reverse order, though. I was going to do TC, then Jackie, then Evelyn. I thought that would be interesting. And that might have been interesting, too, because I think that would have also just altered the reader's sense of time in that way that I'm talking about. I think that might have been interesting too. But there's something about reading about going in a matter of pages from something in the 40s to something in the 80s and then, something in post-Katrina New Orleans. I think there's something about that, the proximity of those experiences and the juxtaposition that really makes the reader or helps the reader to understand that things haven't changed much. And that was my hope, at least.
Right. I think you achieved that very, very well. Let's spell out for our listeners these three generations and the primary characters whom we meet. The novel opens with the earliest of the stories from the late 1940s. Or I should say 1944, late in the Second World War, when we meet a nursing student by the name of Evelyn, who is Creole. And her father is a doctor and has achieved a very solid place in the community and wants that for his daughter or better. And, of course, the problem is that she falls in love with someone who does not align with her father's highest hopes. Tell us about the man, Renard, with whom Evelyn is attracted and ultimately falls in love.
Well, he has an enormous amount of integrity. He's had, it's the 40s and he lives in the Jim Crow South, and his life is certainly not as privileged as Evelyn's, and most black people's weren't at that time. She's from an exceptional category of experience. But, despite his setbacks, he has these huge ambitions to be a doctor, and he has an enormous amount of integrity, and I think he has a chip on his shoulder, especially with regard to dating someone who's so privileged. But he's willing to try, and really I think he's the rock of that family, and it's only the systemic structures that came in place that that interfered with the legacy I think he might have had.
I really love a moment first of all, I love the way you craft the account of their courtship, which is very hesitant.
Yeah,
I mean, it does not take off like a rocket at all. And as we read it, we are left to wonder, is this going to turn into anything? And of course, eventually it does. But I should think you had a lot of fun kind of thinking about what words to give these two characters, how to write this so the way that Renard behaves, his halting hesitancy feels very, very real, as though this is very much the way a relationship would emerge from two people from two such distinct classes.
Oh, well, thank you. And it was really fun, and it was fun to try to keep it true to the time period as well, and a lot of that hesitance on his part is just what I imagined it would be like, during that time when the standard was just a little bit different for how soon things happen in a relationship. And, and of course she's from such a polished background. So it was fun. It was fun to write that relationship developing, and still trying to keep it, you know, develop the way any relationship would develop, but you had to keep these like proper, proper parameters around it.
I appreciate the moment when you have Evelyn's father, again, who is a successful doctor, who is anxious that her daughter does very, very well for herself and on behalf of the family. And one of the things that he says to her is, you could have any boy in this neighborhood, in this country, I might dare say. You have your whole life ahead of you. Who knows whom you'll meet out there? You're so young. You don't know what it means to have choices. Don't throw your life away over a low imagination. What an interesting choice of terms. I've never seen that before, that concept of low imagination. But one can see how those words would really resonate with someone who's maybe lived a life in which they've had to do a whole lot of settling as opposed to striving for something better.
Yeah, I hear you. And thank you for pointing that out, because I hadn't, you know, you write all these words, you don't necessarily zero in on all of them. And I thought you were going to talk about this other passage that reminds me of, where he says, you know, you think the world is one way because I've made it that way for you. I'm paraphrasing, but the sense that he sheltered her so much that she believes that her choices won't have consequences. And I thought that was interesting too. It's just really, I mean, it's what any parent would try to do for their child, but the fact that he's able to do it in the 40s in that environment, and so the reader knows so much more than Evelyn does at that time about what the consequences could be. A lot of that is because we've seen the future through the book, but a lot of it too is because we know the weight of history. And I mean, Evelyn is so sheltered in that way, like that line she has about slavery, how, you know, it was only a vague notion she had of it. It wasn't real to her, and that's the way the war felt. I mean, she's so sheltered, and so it's interesting to see how the father is sort of the voice for what the reader senses and knows about history and about the future.
Well, absolutely. And I also appreciate the fact that it is the relationship between Renard and Evelyn that, in a sense, stokes Renard's own sense of confidence and determination. And this is at a point when the money is not flowing anymore from a friend's mother to pay for Renard's education. And he is trying to spell all this out for Evelyn. He said, they said they would pay for my schooling. Andrew's mama can't pay anymore, and I promised myself I would finish no matter what. He's explaining why he enlisted in the Army. What other option did I have? Work at Todd's for the rest of my life, saying yes, sir, to the manager with my eyes on my shoes, pay officers half my pay just so they'll leave me be? He paused, looked at her, his brown eyes shining. It's no way to live, but I could have survived it if I hadn't met you. I want better for you. I want better for us. The idea that just in having someone else in your life, that in and of itself makes you want to have a better life for the sake of both of you and the life that you want to share together. I had just never stopped to think about the role that something like that could play in someone's life.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for saying that. And yeah, it's interesting. I love how you put it, that it stokes an inner confidence in him that's even something he can dare to attain at some point. I'm proud of him. Of all the characters in the book, I'm really proud of him. I feel that he and Evelyn too, but, you know, he came from such a poor background. I think he did a really great job.
Yeah, no kidding. His nickname at one point is the Uneven Man, because he's a little bit unkempt looking and certainly not handsome, but there is a lot to admire about him and a lot to love, as it turns out. Well, jumping ahead, the second generation involves the daughter of Evelyn and Renard many decades later. Her name is Jackie, and it is the story of the very, very turbulent relationship between her and a man named Terry, who is contending with very serious substance abuse. And there is this sense that there's always the possibility that even when they are trying to rebuild the life they had, that it's all going to crumble away. At one point, she says she felt like every evenness she had regained was being snatched back, that she was doomed to a certain and dark fate. Talk for a moment about the challenge of crafting the story of Jackie and Terry and of sort of mixing together the right proportions of hope and hopelessness.
That's a really good question. I think the biggest challenge for me in writing that was zeroing in on what I thought the connection between Evelyn's section and TC's section was. I always had Evelyn's section and I always had TC's. I knew that Evelyn would be polished and that her grandson would be in and out of jail. But I didn't understand what happened in the 80s to create a child like TC. And so I went through many, many drafts of Jackie's section, and it wasn't the case for the other two. With the other two sections, they just came out. But I went through many, many different versions of Jackie's section, and I finally, through research, realized I wanted to lay the blame on the war on drugs, basically. I think that's, and the mass incarceration that followed from that, and just the mishandling of the crack cocaine epidemic, treating it in a criminal way as opposed to a health crisis. I realized that was so significantly responsible for a lot of what we see today. And so then I started to have to figure out, well, how am I going to make that a story? You know, I mean, that's the sociological theory, but how are you going to make that a story? And I thought, well, maybe her husband is on drugs. And so that came to me, but then I had to figure out how much of the emphasis I wanted to put on his drug use. You know, it could have been a totally different story. It could have been, you know, she doesn't know he's on drugs, and then she finds out he's on drugs, and then she, you know, and then she has to battle with him over rehab, and they get through that. And, you know, I could have had much more of an emphasis on that aspect of it, but I didn't really want to show that. I just wanted to show more of the shared humanity, and I think a relationship is a great way to do that. I think just especially the high points of that relationship, I thought that would be a nice way to allow the reader to empathize with the characters, despite some obvious differences that most readers would have between themselves and these characters, especially Terry.
Right, absolutely. And of course, when Terry shows up, Jackie is confronted with some really difficult choices about whether or not to allow him back into her life, and what will her family say, and at what point should she even let them know. And and it's so interesting, at one point when she's thinking about whether or not if it makes sense to reveal any of this to her family, you have her thinking that we decided we'd wait to tell my family, that it would just add another layer of pressure, a group of people waiting on you to fail. And of course, mm-hmm. I think most of us, even if we haven't found ourselves in these kind of really difficult circumstances, can think of ways in which family sometimes is that group of people whom we do not want to disappoint. And it's one of
right.
the worst feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You also give to Jackie one of the best lines in the entire novel, this idea of this idea that life could drag disgrace out of you. And I think that's such an interesting way to put it, that the lesson she has learned the hard way, that life could drag disgrace out of you. And our heart just breaks for somebody who finds themselves in that kind of circumstance and not knowing exactly how to escape it.
Thank you. I really like that line too, and it is heartbreaking to think of someone, and you know, she's not even 90. You know, she's in her 30s.
Right.
And to already have that idea. that life could drag disgrace out of you. You know, it's something you would expect to see in the mind of a person who's, you know, facing death and they've had a terrible life, but they're in their 80s or something. You know what I mean? But she's in her 30s and she already thinks that. It's really interesting.
Right, exactly. And it's so sad to think about somebody at a point in life when things should be blooming and flourishing.
Right.
And instead, she's hanging on desperately and so worried about the next thing. I mean, living with a terrible kind of uncertainty. The third and final generation is Jackie and Terry's son, TC. And part of what we'll say about his story is that, in his words, he had been square before the storm, namely Katrina.
Yeah.
But it is in the wake of Hurricane Katrina and in the midst of trying to rebuild some semblance of a life that he gets into trouble himself. Say a word about the special challenge of writing a story positioned after Hurricane Katrina in the aftermath of that devastation.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. And you know, there are so many elements to that. Like, I didn't want it to be a Katrina story. You know, I felt at that time that Desmond Ward had written a great Katrina story, and I just that just wasn't what I was going to do. I wasn't going to talk about the storm, you know, or I wasn't going to talk about people in the face of the storm, I'll put it that way. But I did want to talk about the aftermath in a quiet way, because I think that's how many New Orleans many New Orleanians feel, that the storm is obviously still affecting them, but it's in a quiet way. It's in a subtle way. You know, much of the city is back together. You know, you go in most areas, you wouldn't know it had happened, but many, many people wake up and they can't go a day without thinking about what happened before Katrina and what happened after Katrina. And when people describe things to you, they'll say, oh, that was before Katrina, or they'll say, oh, yeah, that was right after Katrina. It's kind of like the baseline or the framework for the way they think about their lives. And so I wanted to show the psychological impact that storm has had. I don't think that's been addressed enough. And the way it could creep up in someone's life and create havoc. And you wouldn't really know that it was that had caused it, but it was certainly trauma and certainly had a huge impact, especially on everyone, but especially on the children who experienced it. And TC is one of those children.
Right, absolutely.
And, yeah.
And in many ways, you have him thinking as he's first getting out of jail, thinking back on his life and all of the ways in which he has been a disappointment to himself and others, talking about one more example of his not quiteness, of being not quite what he should be or the kind of man that he could be. I also think it's interesting that at one point when he is in the midst of, I think, smoking some marijuana and kind of experiencing that high, that one of the things he experiences in the wake of that is feeling like his problems are repositioned as opportunities. That one of the things that is so alluring about that is the way in which it makes things that would be or should be seen as very negative and to be avoided suddenly seem like enticing possibilities. That's really sad to think about, isn't it? I mean, because what an enticing trap it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. And then I just loved writing that character so much. I can't even tell you. I missed him when I was done with that section. I just thought, you know, it's true. I mean, his set of circumstances is very sad, and I won't give anything away, but on the other hand, I thought his spirit was just so indomitable and just alluring, and I just really liked spending time with him on the page, because it's just that kind of thing. Like, you know, he smokes and his problems are suddenly opportunities. And I you know what I think I'm trying to say is that he's a kid, and you see that even – that's what I wanted to show, and that's what I see when I read it. He's a kid, even though he has so many more problems than a kid should, and than most kids do. he's just a kid, and I think that spirit really shines through his character.
Absolutely. Your book reminds me of a recent TED Talk from 2017 by Rutger Bregman, in which he talks about the poor decisions that poor people sometimes make, and the blithe assumption that too many of us make that poor people are poor because they're dumb, and because they're dumb, they're making a lot of dumb decisions that undercut what otherwise might be successful lives, and thus they are, in a sense, to blame for their own poverty. And Rutger Bregman very persuasively makes the case that poor people are making sometimes poor decisions because of the circumstances in which they find themselves. They are not making dumb decisions, he says, because they are dumb, but because they're living in a context in which any one of us would make dumb decisions. And in a sense, that's part of what is going on in your novel, with many of these characters contending with a plethora of challenges and difficulties, sometimes managing to make the right decision, and in many other cases, making decisions that weigh them down and carry them further down. And that's part of what makes this novel so very, very powerful.
Yeah, and I think I don't know if I'm familiar with the TED Talk, but I read an article about that, about how you kind of get into a pattern where you know you're not going to have these big yields of opportunity or big yields of finances or anything like that. So you settle for the little burst you can get, and oftentimes those entail making bad decisions because you're just trying to get a little bit of pleasure. Is that same premise that you're talking about? I read an article about that with why poor people seem to make decisions that drive them further into their poverty. In this book, you know, it's funny because Evelyn's certainly not poor. Jackie's middle class, and she has the agency of using her father's money if she wants, but they're still inhabited by that sense of desperation and limited opportunity, and much of that is really not due to any personal fault of their own. It's just the environment that those characters are living in.
Absolutely, and the idea is that any of us would make some poor decisions were we thrust into those same circumstances.
That's right. That's right.
I love the rich mix of experience that is part of this book. And at turns, it is a heartbreaking novel, but also at many turns, incredibly inspiring, sometimes hilariously funny. I mean, I said at the top, emotionally rich, and I really mean it. Again, it's titled A Kind of Freedom. It is published now in paperback by Counterpoint and the author, Margaret Wilkerson Sexton. Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, congratulations on a marvelous debut novel. We look forward to seeing more of your work in the years to come. And thanks for being part of The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be previewing for you the upcoming nonprofit leadership conference at the University of Wisconsin Parkside with Deborah Karp, who is coordinating the event, and Undre Howard, who is the featured speaker. And on Friday, I'm very excited about putting in the guest seat my WGTD colleague, Dave McGrath, our news director, who is now Dave McGrath, author, responsible for a really interesting new book called Gene Pitney, The Singer, The Songs, The Songwriters. in which he examines the long and distinguished career of Gene Pitney, with whom Dave worked very, very closely for many, many years. It's going to be an exciting day on the program. I hope you make a special point of joining us. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The